It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
We don't have a Maria with us today.
We're doing the trade-off. Fortunately the IV drip is relatively silent. So we can do our show this week without too much fear of interruption.
Right.
But I was sick as a dog last week and wound up in the hospital and got out and been recuperating, and now Maria's sick as a dog. So if she's probably not listening at home, she's probably
home sleeping like sensible people are.
Yeah, but. We certainly hope that she gets better, and we'll come back and do the big year-end extravaganza next week, where we can actually both be on the air at the same time and talk about what went wrong and what went right and what went horribly awry in the past year and all that good stuff. But for this week, there was a lot going on while I was away.
There was, as usual. They wait till you're out of it to pull some of their shenanigans.
Yeah, although I have to say that you know, being in the hospital and being on morphine and other hallucinogenic drugs when the news of Saddam Hussein's capture is blaring from every hall and cubicle is just a tad bit surreal. Boy, did I get a reminder this past week as to why I don't like watching television news, but.
I would have think they would have had to medicate you more for that, as you know, they crank.
Well, TV news, I think, is kind of a drug of its own, which is, you know, why I and Maria and anybody who probably listens to this show understands the value of the internet and finding foreign news, because there was an awful lot that went on in Iraq this week that didn't have anything to do at all with Saddam Hussein's capture. As most events in Iraq from this point out won't. But we might as well start with that because those little machines that they have in university research stations around the country that measure eruptions of hypocrisy from Washington, D.C., where we're all, you know, pretty much trembling and some actually suffer quite a bit of damage this past week with the coverage of Saddam's capture, and they talked about it a little bit on Counterspin right now, just how much hypocrisy and how much of a double standard there was. But I wanted to underscore a few things from that. First of all, just as a helpful reminder, the capture of Saddam Hussein was not the reason that the United States invaded Iraq. In fact, if people can remember all the way back to March of this year, we'll do our little year-end retrospective a week early. March 17th, the day that President Bush gave his ultimatum to Iraq before an invasion, what he did was give Saddam Hussein 48 hours to accept exile to a foreign country, which was believed to be Saudi Arabia. That was, at that point, perfectly acceptable to the United States and to George Bush. The Bush administration had no interest in trying this guy for war crimes, capturing him, let alone trying him. And now they're talking about putting him on trial. And it's important to underscore that they are talking about putting him on trial in what would be a show trial. It would be run by the Americans. The outcome would be preordained. And, you know, we were already talking about, Bush speculating about wanting basically to execute the guy. It's not like there's any doubt what the outcome of the trial would be. But there is a procedure in place that the international community has now agreed upon for what to do with these people who are accused pretty much indisputably in Saddam's case of crimes against humanity. And when you're talking about tens, even hundreds of thousands of dead bodies, what you are talking about is crimes against humanity. Most countries in the world have now signed the convention that arranges for an international tribunal to try these people. The United States is the conspicuous exception that has refused to sign on. And, of course, the reason that it has refused to sign on is that, people like George Bush are worried that they might be And their generals and soldiers might be targets for inquiry themselves one day. And just, you know, parenthetically, you can try to imagine by contrast, you know, whether George Bush, were he, just say hypothetically, you know, being hounded by a foreign power and accused of war crimes and threatened with the prospect of being hauled before an international tribunal, whether he would, you know, accept a comfortable life in exile in some country someday, or whether he would, you know, be hiding out like a desperado in a hole in the ground. I mean, you know, you have a pretty good idea what courageous moral choice Mr. Bush would make. But be that as it may, there are a number of really instructive examples of people in the past of the United States' own foreign policy that are being treated very differently. And a couple of notable examples, of course, you know, we have Donald Rumsfeld. There was a very good report in yesterday's Washington Post about Rumsfeld's trips to Baghdad in December of 1983 and March of 1984 during the Iran-Iraq War, trips that were designed to reinstate diplomatic relations between Iraq and the United States at the time of the Iraq-Iran War, and to sell arms, basically, to Iraq. The U.S. was officially neutral during that conflict, but unofficially, the U.S. was very much on the side of Saddam Hussein in that war. And the whole reason for his second trip, the first trip was all about trying to reestablish diplomatic relations, and the British had already paved the way in this. The second trip was after Saddam Hussein, the accusations had come to light that he was using gas in the war, that he was using chemical weapons, weapons of what we now call mass destruction. And the United States, of course, issued its ritual condemnations of such use. And this confused the Iraqis mightily, because these were not the signals they were getting from Washington. And so Rumsfeld, at that point, as President Reagan's special envoy to the Middle East, was duly dispatched, and through Freedom of Information Acts, this was just uncovered in public records and in newly declassified documents in the past couple of months, which is why it was in the news this week. The instructions to envoy from then Secretary of State George Shultz, saying that you know, reassure Tariq Aziz, who was then Saddam's young, you know, foreign minister, and the Iraqi people, that, you know, what we're saying for public consumption is just for public consumption. Really, you know, as long, whatever they do on their own dime, you know, we don't really care that much. It's okay. Well, you were really people that you can do business with. And that message was duly conveyed, and we continued to sell the weapons with which Saddam Hussein made his weapons of mass destruction, for which the U.S. will now put him on trial. Now, will he, Saddam Hussein, that is, use that sort of information, as Slobodan Milosevic did during his defense in the NATO trial in The Hague, which was the last example of a show trial being shuffled than of the show trial of the NATO variety, rather than the U.S. Using the International Tribunal. Slobodan Milosevic used as his defense this long line over a period of 10 years of, you know, cables of financiers, the network of arms dealers, the diplomatic messages, the high-level communiques from prime ministers and presidents, saying that what he was doing in terms of his butchery in the Balkans was A-OK by them, and they would continue to sell him weapons. That information didn't come out much in the U.S. media. Who knows whether Saddam will even be given that opportunity with the Americans show managing the trial? Yeah, it's not very likely. But there's an even more interesting example that's going to come to light in Guatemala with former General Efrén Ríos Montt, who just ran for president in November, finished third in a field of, you know, however many million actually run for president in many countries where you can have more than two choices. But he has been president of Congress for the last several years. He was the president, actually dictator, general who seized power in a military coup in late 1981, a coup backed by the United States, taking power from another general backed by the United States, as there had been a succession of such military dictators in Guatemala since the U.S. had overthrown a democratically elected government there in 1954. That being the history behind it, Rios Montt, during his 16 months of power in 1981 and 82, slaughtered some 70,000 people in a systematic scorched-earth campaign going through mostly indigenous Mayan villages in the highlands of Guatemala, villages thought to be sympathetic to guerrillas in a long-standing civil war. The generals of Guatemala went through with U.S. assistance, many of these folks graduates of the School of the Americas, which we talked about in recent weeks, went through village by village and, you know, burned everything, any living thing, any structure. All of it was killed. All of it was burned to the ground.
300 villages.
I think the number was 440, okay. Actually. It was a huge number. And in the meantime, you had, you know, Ronald Reagan signing an additional waiver to a restriction on arms sales to Guatemala, insisting that Rios Montt was a born-again Christian, that he was getting a bum rap. He was totally dedicated to democracy. The U.S. Embassy issued a report labeling accusations of crimes against humanity against Montt as being basically commie disinformation. Troy Skiles, actually, in Eat the State, had a very good article on Montt about a month ago that would be on the web under the generals, the election, or something like that. That's a title. People would recognize it. It's eatthestate.org. But anyway, Montt, because he lost the election in his bid for president last year, this past month, and is retiring from Congress next month, loses his diplomatic immunity against prosecution for war crimes. Now, set aside for the moment the notion that crimes against humanity or war crimes are something that can have diplomatic immunity. The whole idea that, you know, you can kill hundreds of thousands of people, but it's okay because you were elected to do so is kind of preposterous, since most of these crimes are completely legal in the countries in which they're committed because the people committing the crimes passed laws to make them legal. That's just the nature of who has the power to commit murder on that kind of scale. So set aside the notion of that kind of absurdity, there are in fact two cases for the prosecution of war crimes, crimes against humanity, pending against Montt by survivors of families of his victims. One, Rigoberta Menchu, and some other survivors are prosecuting in a Spanish court, the same court, I think, in fact, that that prosecuted Pinochet in Chile, and then another in Guatemalan courts, a separate case that is proceeding. Will the Bush administration and the United States, with its new high-minded zeal for prosecuting committers of war crimes, go after Rios Montt and his enablers? Well, probably not, because many of those enablers are now in Bush 43's foreign policy establishment. You know, you have Elliot Abrams, you have, you know, the long list of people who committed or who financed or who gave marching orders to all of these committers of these horrible crimes in places like Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras in the 80s.
John Negroponte.
Absolutely.
Our UN envoy, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, these are people with a tremendous amount of blood on their hands. And this is a history that is known by the rest of the world, that is being paid attention to much more than it is in this country. And it's not just a history that's limited to Latin America. You see it also in Africa. You see it, even going back to the 2 million dead in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos, and what Nixon and Kissinger in particular did there. But, you know, all of the different tin horn dictators there. And you're seeing it all over again post 9/11 in the way the Bush administration is cozying up to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, especially to Pakistan, to Uzbekistan, to some of these more obscure dictatorships in Central Asia. These are the Saddams of 20 years from now. And this is what we're not hearing about. So you have all of this as backdrop and all of this discussion as what media coverage is not talking about during the capture of Saddam Hussein. What is being talked about, very similar to what happened when Saddam's sons were captured a few months ago, speaking of another event that has gone down the memory hole, of how this will mean the end of the uprising. This will mean the end of the resistance. The guerrilla fighters were all being secretly dictated to by Saddam Hussein. Now that he's gone, they'll just give up and walk away. Well, this was all said when his sons were killed in that shootout back in June or whatever it was. And instead, there was a dramatic uptick in the resistance, and it was an uptick that wasn't just an uptick, but it was a permanently ramping up that happened just about the same time, and it's continued to escalate ever since then. The same thing's going to happen here. You know, we've been talking about on this program, Maria in This Week in Iraq has been talking about for weeks that this is not a bunch of bitter enders. This is not a bunch of Ba'ath Party loyalists fighting to the very end. You know, did Saddam Hussein have people in his intelligence and security apparatus who are going to remain loyal, who had contingency plans for a guerrilla war in place, who were trying to provide resistance to the Americans? Well, of course, they'd be idiots if they didn't. But that's not where most of this is coming from. It's coming from a number of different multiple sources, most of which have nothing to do with loyalty for Saddam Hussein. And, you know, we saw that again this week, if we want to move into this week in Iraq segment, because there was a lot that continued to happen this week.
It just keeps going. So
basically, the upshot was in the few days after the capture of Saddam Hussein, you had... didn't make much news here because it wasn't until Thursday that you had any U.S. soldiers killed this week. But that is because, and this is something Maria has been talking about for a couple weeks on this show, the resistance fighters have been moving their targets away from the hard targets of U.S. troops and toward the soft targets presented by corroborating Iraqis, particularly Iraqi policemen. The fabled White House trick of burying bad news on a Friday. I almost look for the guaranteed Friday release of information embarrassing to the White House. And one of the ones that trickled out yesterday was that Paul Bremer was in a convoy a couple weeks ago that was attacked by a roadside bomb. And, you know, they're insisting, oh, no, it was not an assassination attempt because nobody knew Bremer's schedule. And it was just a random event. And if you go to foreign press accounts of this, they quite freely call it an assassination attempt. Similarly, you had a very damaging, by all appearances, a suicide bomb attack in Baghdad last, I believe it's Sunday. And of course, you know, legendarily on this program, I can't read my own notes at the moment, but it involved the collision of a packed bus with a fuel oil tanker and the resulting explosion. And the U.S. military on the scene is insisting that this was an accident. It just happened to be a tragic accident, you know, in the middle of wartime Baghdad. It just happened to be that, you know, an accident with an explosive oil tanker, and a packed vehicle full of people resulted in 10 fatalities and a number of injuries, and the U.S. military insisting it was not a suicide bomb. Well, Iraqi police are saying that it was a suicide bomb. Every witness on the scene is saying it was a suicide bomb. You have accounts in the British press of ordinary Iraqis, young men, literally picking up pieces of flesh of some of the victims and burying them in little sort of impromptu roadside graves, and talking about how the U.S. military, you know, if this is an accident scene, they can't even be bothered coming out trying to do some of the basic details that are involved in respect for the dead, of recovering the bodies of the victims. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that's enraging ordinary Iraqis, particularly, you know, the Muslim faith is considers very important the very prompt burial of people who've been killed. I mean, you know, like literally very, very quick. you know, it speaks both to the nervousness of U.S. troops for being in an exposed situation like that, of doing the ordinary sort of security details that you would expect a peacekeeping force to be doing in a country, and the fact that, you know, if we're such a secure situation and this was not an adversarial situation at all, then, you know, what would be the problem of doing that kind of work? You know, very likely it was a suicide bomb attack. At the same time, you had 19 fatalities, 17 policemen being fatalities in a town called Qaldiya, 50 miles west of Baghdad, on Sunday, the same day as Saddam Hussein's capture. Again, targeting of Iraqi policemen, of soft targets, of the collaborators. All in all, in the first 3 or 4 days after Saddam's capture, you had 40 deaths of Iraqi civilians, mostly policemen. I shouldn't say necessarily civilians, because they were targeted because of who they were. You also had some high-level assassinations this week, in particular a Shia leader, a cleric named Muhammad al-Hakim, was shot outside Baghdad, in his home outside Baghdad, on Thursday, by people who were ascribed to be Ba'ath Party loyalists. This is a phrase you hear over and over again. You know, this is an insurgency that is not going away, and yet what you see repeatedly in U.S. media and out of quotes from the military and quotes from the White House is that we got Saddam Hussein, we captured these papers from him, these papers detailed resistance cells, we're picking up the resistance fighters, they're on their run, their back is broken, yeah, there'll be some attacks going for a little while, but you know, the resistance is basically over. This was a major turning point. You know, all you can really say as we go into 2004 is, you know, we'll see. The U.S. has made a promise now to be out of the country and offering Iraqi self-rule by July of this year, when they don't even know yet what form of government will take. They don't have any plan whatsoever for dealing with the numerous you know, difficulties between different rival political and ethnic and religious and tribal factions. The U.S. is going to be bogged down in Iraq for a long, long time to come, and Saddam's capture did not change that one iota.
On a related note, I saw in the UK Independent this week, there was an article about David Kaye, the lead U.S. weapons inspector, is going to quit. And prior to his he was supposed to be done in, I believe, the spring of next year. He's going to announce that he's going to quit. And currently there's only, I think there was somewhere between 1,100 and 1,400 inspectors that the U.S. had sent in. There's only like 40 now in the country.
Well, there's nothing left to look for. I mean,
right. You know, but I thought it was interesting that they, this being the primary reason, of course, that the U.S. said that they're going in, and that
And a little bit of context also, because we're talking here and in Afghanistan with civilizations that have continuously inhabited the same region for, you know, several thousand years, where a year here, 2 years there is not a big deal. You had Al-Qaeda issuing a tape that was aired on Al Jazeera yesterday that was a warning to Americans, which obviously most Americans did not hear, but you know, talking about how they're intending to wage further attacks on the American homeland as well as in Afghanistan. The Taliban is regaining strength in the mountains. It's been 2 years since the major firefight at Tora Bora in eastern Afghanistan. Only 2 years. A lot has happened since then, but that's a drop in the bucket for some of these people in places like Afghanistan, where the Taliban are regrouping, for groups like Al-Qaeda, for resistance fighters in Iraq. They're in this for the long haul. You know, people in this country are used to short, quick-term fixes. Well, Saddam is captured, everything will go away. You know, there will be a functioning constitutional democracy in 6 months. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, that show called Iraq, I guess, has been renewed for next season. So,
and the season beyond, and the season beyond. Actually, we have a much better chance of canceling the Bush administration show than we have of canceling the Iraq occupation show.
All right. Related to all this, there was a big court decision this week related to terrorists and
yeah. Jose speaking of things that need to be canceled, Jose Padilla, which people may remember as the dirty bomber, you know, yet another one of these hysterical warnings from the Bush administration meant to whip up fear that happened in the summer of 2002, 18 months now. That Jose Padilla has been held incommunicado in a Navy brig outside Charleston, South Carolina. We've talked about this on the show, of course, where the evidence is totally inconclusive as to whether we do know is that he is a guy with a long history of gang-related offenses in the Chicago area, that he's a converted Muslim, and that he traveled extensively in the Middle East. Now, whether this makes him a terrorist and nuclear bomb plotter, whether this makes him an Al-Qaeda wannabe or a mid-level drug runner or an interested religious tourist is anybody's guess. And the whole point is that it's anybody's guess because he's never been allowed to be brought to trial because he was held as an unlawful enemy combatant. You know, one of the Bush administration... I'm drawing the blank on the word that I want. Strategies for assaultings on civil liberties. There was a three-panel federal appeals court ruling in Manhattan this week that overturned that. It'll probably go on to the Supreme Court at this point. And both the two judges that ruled against the federal government and the one that ruled for made it very clear that this is a huge constitutional issue. What powers do the commander-in-chief have to supersede Congress, to supersede the Constitution, to make the determination of when there is a military threat on U.S. soil and what can be done to basic rights of Americans in that. Most of the court decisions to this point have gone against the Bush administration, but it really underscores two things. Number one, the radical nature with which the whole thing about holding people at Guantanamo Bay, the Patriot II, the recent amendment to the intelligence appropriations for next year that allow financial institutions to be searched, you know, all of that, a tremendously radical agenda. And if any of it sticks, it's a tremendous setback for civil liberties. And secondly, all of that's going to wind up in the laps of the Supreme Court sooner or later. You've got two people in their 70s and another in their 80s, another person at least in their 80s. There's going to be at least two, maybe three vacancies in the U.S. Supreme Court in the next 4 years. It really underscores, again, how important next year's election is, because whoever is in the White House between now and 2008 is going to have a chance to set the direction of the U.S. Supreme Court for a generation.
And conversely, who's ever in the Supreme Court gets to choose who's in the White House.
So. Yeah, it's really you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of setup, isn't it? The kind of thing that happens in little, you know, ten horn dictatorships that wind up going on trial for war crimes.
Mm. But not here.
No.
Let's, just a couple minutes left, plug a couple events that are coming up this weekend.
Yeah, Dick Cheney, speaking of war criminals and people with blood on their hands, is coming to the Seattle area, specifically to Bellevue, for a fundraiser for next year's election. He'll be at the Hyatt Regency on Monday night raising money with the big wigs there. It's a little bit more accessible than Craig McCaw's house. And so there will be a protest. It's scheduled from 5:30 to 8:30. And I believe the permitted location is at Bellevue Way and 8th Northeast in Bellevue, Northeast 8th, from all the way through rush hour from 5:30 on. And then I'm sure people will be trying to get as close as they can to the Hyatt Regency as well. And then also for people who want a direct sort of first-person account of what's going on in Iraq, a couple of women Iraqi activists who can also talk about what has happened in terms of the movement backward for women's rights in Iraq since the U.S. forces came in April. Similar to Afghanistan, there's been no improvement at all. In fact, it's made quite a bit worse. A couple of women activists will be in town at the behest of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. They will be here tomorrow night at University Friends Meeting, 40th and 9th Northeast in the U District at 7 o'clock. So please go to that.
Yeah, they can commiserate with women in this country whose rights have gotten worse in that same time period. With that, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And, Jav, where do people find Eat the State?
Well, it's a publication that comes out every couple of weeks, depending on which of our editors is healthy that week. It's a free newspaper that comes out where you find free papers at bookstores and cafes and places like that. It's also on the web, as are all of our past archived issues at www.eatthestate.org. We'll have the new issue up just as soon as the editor who's responsible for doing that gets over their current illness. We got a lot of people down right now. And then we also have coming up in the coming week our annual list of most overhyped and underreported stories of the year. And we'll, I'm sure, talk about that on this program next week, too. And always, Eat the State makes a fine holiday gift idea. We have a special going on. Get one subscription, get another at half price. You can find information for that in the paper or on the web, or just send your checks. $45 for 2 years, $25 for one. P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. Donations also accepted. And if you missed any of that, our voicemail with all the information you would want, or for comments or for feedback or volunteering, it's area code 206-903-9461.